Bursal.
Today on Straight Talk Africa, the politics of power transitions in Africa. Is there life after occupying the state house or seat of power? That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali. And today we are discussing the variety of political transitions on the continent. At the beginning of 2019, voters from 10 African nations were scheduled to vote in general elections. So far, only Nigeria, Senegal, Comoros, South Africa, and Malawi have held elections. But there has been no transfer of power. My colleague Paul Ndiho has more on the story.
Tens of millions of Africans have gone to the polls in an effort to use the ballot box to deepen the quality of democratic governance and bring about political transitions. However, ONRE, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, has had a peaceful transfer of power. On January 24th, Felix Tshisekedi was sworn in as DRC's president, making the country's first ever peaceful handover of power after multiple bitterly disputed elections since the country gained independence from Belgium in 1960.
I do solemnly swear before God and the nation to observe and to defend the Constitution and the laws of the Republic.
Perhaps the symbolism of one leader handing over the presidency to another, as President Joseph Kabila wrapped the presidential sash around his successor, was in sharp contrast to what we have often seen on the continent. In Sudan, Omar al-Bashir was ousted as president by the military in April. He ruled Sudan with an iron fist for 30 years before he was overthrown following mass protests that have rocked the country since December 2018. The military announced that it would set up a transition military council to run the country for up to 2 years, but pro-democracy demonstrators are firmly rejecting that plan. Earlier this month, Sudanese ex-president Omar al-Bashir appeared before a prosecutor in Khartoum, where he was charged with corruption-related offenses. In Senegal, President Macky Sall easily won re-election. Senegal has long been viewed as the region's most stable democracy. It's worth mentioning that two of the best-known opposition figures were banned from running in the February election due to corruption convictions that rights groups say were politically motivated. Also in West Africa, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari took the oath of office in May for a second 4-year term to the cheers of many Nigerians who looked forward to a brighter future at the Eagle Square in the heart of Abuja.
With leadership and sense of purpose, we can lift 100 million Nigerians out of poverty.
Buhari, 76, won with 15.2 million votes. The opposition claims that vote rigging and corruption murdered this election. In 2015, Buhari was Nigeria's first democratically elected opposition candidate to be handed power from incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan in the nation's history. South Africa's Cyril Ramaphosa was sworn in as president, vowing to create jobs and tackle deep-rooted corruption.
I'm also aware of the challenges our country faces, but I'm also alive to the fact that our people are filled with hope for a better tomorrow.
Ramaphosa becomes the country's fourth democratically elected president since the end of the apartheid era in 1994. Malawian President Peter Mutharika was sworn in last month for a second term after a contentious election marred by allegations of fraud and vote rigging. Malawi's opposition rejected the results and are calling for countrywide demonstrations over the disputed results. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Our distinguished guest today, Dr. Yetunde Odubasan Omede, Professor of Global Affairs and Politics at Farmingdale State College. Dr. Hashim L. Tineh, founder and president, International Peace Quest Institute. And by phone from Ethiopia, we are expected to be joined by the Aya Chebi, the African Union Youth Envoy. I have to say that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Thank you, and we are also honored to be here and to continue the conversation with you in your wonderful program.
You're most welcome. And can we go to Addis Ababa? Aya, let me come to you. Good evening. Well, I gather that we're still having some technical difficulties. Let me come immediately to you, Yetunde.
Yes.
First of all, I have to say again that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to host you.
Thank you.
For the first time.
Yeah.
On Straight Talk Africa, even though I understand.
Yes.
You've actually been a guest on the show before.
Yes. First time with you.
Very interesting. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
How was the journey from New York?
Oh, very good, thank you.
Very interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, let's look at Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Nigeria has gone through a lot of transitions.
Yes.
And this particular, this last one, you had an election.
Mm-hmm.
And an election for some strange reason, which has not satisfied many people.
Right.
It seems to have been different from the one that was held in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Which, when you think about it, both Nigerians and the international community
mm-hmm.
Agreed that it was an election that met the highest democratic
Absolutely.
Threshold.
Yes, peaceful transfer of power.
Under Professor Atahir
mm-hmm.
Jega.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What happened this time?
Well, I think there's it varied. In terms of just the election being halted, people preparing for one day, international news, global attention, knowing that, okay, the election will take place one day, and for people to go to the polls and to find out, I believe, even the night before, that the election would not take place, was a total dismay to so many people who had traveled into Nigeria just for the time to vote, right? It's their civic engagement, it's their civic obligation. And that, in a sense, it put a little damper of what we call democratic values when we talk about the process of free and fair elections.
Mm.
And so people began to question, is my vote being counted? Is the voting process actually being held to the highest standards of ethics? And in that process, what we saw is that people got very upset and questioned the government. People are yet to be satisfied. However, our incumbent president will continue to be the president. And we have to sort of move forward on how are we going to now make the changes and the reformations that is necessary, regardless of that setback that we experienced during the electoral period.
Do you get the sense that he commands the confidence of the vast majority of the Nigerian people?
It would be difficult to speak for the vast majority of the Nigerian people. I mean, of course, he has his supporters. And of course, the oppositional party has their supporters as well. We were able to see both sides of the coin. But at the same time, I think people's frustration, and I think one of the things that people are more concerned with, I would say, is to ensure that the concerns and the needs of the Nigerian people are upheld in this go-around. They felt as if their voices and their concerns for security, electricity, and other issues weren't necessarily being held to its highest standard. And I believe that this time around, hopefully the government will use this opportunity to rectify many of those issues and make sure that they push the government forward.
Very interesting. What about you, my friend Hashim? What about the changes in Khartoum, mm-hmm. in the Republic of Sudan? It looks like it wasn't really through what you'd call a barot. Was it a bullet or a combination of a bullet and perhaps people also voting on the streets with their feet?
As you see, I am in blue. And there is, I would like to thank all the people of the world who are in solidarity with the people of Sudan, and who in Facebook chose the color blue to express their sadness about the barbaric action of the Transitional Military Council. Mm-hmm. On the 3rd of this month, the treacherous assassination and killing of hundreds of beautiful, young, optimistic, hopeful Sudanese youth. And allow me here to express our condolences as the International Peace Quest Institute and Salam Sudan Foundation and all our community in Washington, D.C. and in the United States, and all our friends in the different communities who are in solidarity with us, our condolences for the fathers and the mothers of those we lost on the 3rd of June, on the 29th day of Ramadan, which was supposed to be a sacred time. Mm-hmm. And it was a treacherous and a completely devoid of any humanity and any spirituality and any faith. So this is the first thing. Since the 19th of December, our valiant people in Sudan have been up in arms, not in military arms, but as you said, voting with their feet and with their voices peacefully for change. After 30 years of Islamist kind of so-called Islamist dictatorship, military dictatorship. And I think, As you know, my friend, we have been advocating for a peaceful revolution since my experience of 1964 October.
When you were in the university.
Exactly, when I was a student of law, and we actually toppled the first military dictatorship of Sudan, of President Aboud, peacefully. So that's the genesis of our peaceful movement. And this is what we are offering now to the world.
But how come that one seemed to have worked? It was consolidated. What happened this time around?
Yes, because
was this really a revolution, or was it in fact a change of guard?
Well, I think the people are aspiring for making a revolution, a revolutionary change, and I think it's clear that the deep state of al-Bashir and his clientele of 30 years are, of course, there, and they will fight to the death to maintain power, their interests.
Yeah. I see.
So this is what we have against us, but the leadership of the revolution, you know, the change people, it's a fantastic project of a revolution. Now the news from home, you know, just speaking with them before I came, everything is now being mobilized in all of Sudan, in all the villages, the towns, the hamlets, and Khartoum for the 30th of this month, where will be there will be a million kind of person march, mm-hmm. and the idea is that that day will be the day when the revolutionaries will declare a legitimate government. And by the way, Shaka, as you know, and I would like to thank all the people of goodwill who are actually standing with us. And I would like to appeal actually to Google and Facebook to do whatever they can in terms of technology to liberate our people from this incredibly criminal act of the TMC to deprive us from expressing our First Amendment right, which is to express ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Hashim, unfortunately, time is not our best ally, but we'll get a little bit more time later so that you can explain your case. For now, we have to go to the Ethiopian capital in Addis Ababa. Aya, let me come to you. Good evening, Aya.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Terrific. How are you today?
I'm great.
Sorry about the initial technical difficulties, but we are finally connected.
Yes.
Aya, you have described the what people call the Arab Spring as the revolution for dignity. What exactly do you mean? The other question, are Tunisians Arabs or are they Africans?
Interesting question. I'll start with the first one. So for me, the Arab Spring is a Western narrative. It's not how we call our movement. Right in the middle of the revolution, scholars from around the world, particularly from the U.S., came to do research and to document our stories and our revolution. They call it all sorts of names, the Arab Spring, the Arab Awakening, you know, as if we were sleeping and we just woke up, while the revolution has been there since 2006. There is no revolution that happens overnight. It's all underground work that happens, and then it explodes into something that is mass mobilized. The French call it the Jasmine Revolution, which I also don't like because people died for this revolution, and so we can't just compare it to Jasmine. I don't like the Arab Spring naming because North Africans and Tunisians are also Amazigh. Amazigh is indigenous people of North Africa. Amazigh is our indigenous language. And so North Africa is not Arab, it's Arabized. So we were conquered by Arabs, and we were Arabized, and we were Islamized. So for those of us who know our history, you know that we have our indigenous population, our indigenous language, that have been, you know, disappearing year after year. So the people who were in the front line of the revolution were diverse, and in their diversity, we did not stand because of religious affiliation or political affiliation or ethnic affiliation. We stood there because we're all Tunisians. We all belong to this country, and we wanted to stand up for our rights. I think there is also kind of a division historically, politically, economically between North Africa and the rest of the continent. The Sahara before colonization used to be a bridge between us for trade, and for, you know, people moving around and people, getting mixed. But I think once we had these borders, the Sahara became that line of division north of Africa and the rest, and the south of the Sahara. So I think if we look closer to our history, we realize the role of North Africa and the African struggle and the liberation movement. Sorry, we will realize that Mandela was trained in Algeria, actually, and Algeria was a hub of revolutionaries and the movement against apartheid. We will realize that many of the founders of the African Union, Gaddafi, Nasser, Bourguiba, were all North African leaders. So I think it's just for our generation to understand our historic connections and what really link us as Africans, whether it's our liberation struggle, whether it's our history, whether it's our current struggle as a youthful population now with a very similar challenging living and a very similar system, that it's only that when we unite and we unite under the vision of Pan-Africanism that we can all uplift our continent.
As you said, Aya, some of the great founding fathers of the Organization of African Unity included, among others, of course, Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, Bourguiba, of course, from your beautiful country, and Beni Bella of Algeria, you know, among others. Any particular reason, for example, several years ago, I happened to be in Cairo, the Egyptian capital, and a friend of mine told me that he had just gotten back from Africa. He had come from Nairobi, and he was now back in Cairo. Any particular reason why he would say that? And yet, that particular year, Egypt was, in fact, the African champion in terms of football.
Okay, sorry, I didn't hear the actual question.
The question is, any particular reason why sometimes North Africans think that they're not an African, they're not African?
I think it's first, everything starts from education. So as North Africans, we are not, and as many parts of Africa, actually, so I am here in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, and there is also this conversation about are we part of Africa, you know? And I think it starts from education. We start our education systems around Africa from colonialism. But that's not where our history starts. We have a history before colonialism. And so all what we are educated about, for example, in North Africa is Arabized. So I grew up studying Khalid Gibran, you know? I grew up studying Middle Eastern authors. I've never touched a book by another author from south of the Sahara until 2011, when I actually started traveling the continent and started knowing about Achinwa Achebe and Ali Mazrui, and I started being fascinated with all these writers. Mm-hmm. And it's only when you are educated, it's only when you read what the experiences of other countries that you live, that story of the other culture that you don't know about. So I would say one is education. Our education is Francophone and is Arabized, and we do not have access to our African history and our African writers from other parts of Africa. I would say the second is borders. If we do not travel, if we do not meet other people, we hear all these stereotypes, but from both sides, actually, because when I traveled as a Tunisian across the continent, I've been to 30 countries training young people and mobilization and blogging, nonviolence and leadership. And I would be every time asked the same question, you know, you're Arab, you're this, you're that. But I took the time to travel the continent and to explain to every single one, you have a certain stereotype of what a North African look like or what a North African perception about the continent, to unpack that, you know, and to share, part of my culture, part of my history, part of the religious background, the historic background, that is very connected to many of the countries in Africa. So when I went to East Africa and I went to Mombasa and in Swahili, there is a lot of Arabic. And then I go to Dakar in Ramadan and I just break the fast with families, and it's like my family. So, you know, every corner in Africa when I travel, I felt home, because there is something that connects us. But unfortunately, because North Africans also live in their own bubble, and it's very much the world tries to tell North Africa that you are part of the Middle East or you are part of the Mediterranean, you know, the Euro-Med kind of what we call the Euro-Med. And so, and that's fine, you know, if we have multiple identities, we should embrace all of them. But to me, there is an African identity that we have been deprived of, we didn't learn about, and
very
we didn't grow up with. And it took
very
me,
interesting,
you know, it took me.
Aya, let me come to you, mm-hmm. Yetunde. She talked about, for example, Ethiopia, where she is based. Mm-hmm. There are some people there, in fact, a long time ago, who also have had that kind of problem. There's a book, in fact, called Comparative Politics. Mm-hmm. And people coming from Addis Ababa actually going to very nearby Nairobi, mm-hmm. also somehow thought they were, in fact, going to Africa. And yet, when you think about the fact that the emperor of Ethiopia, mm-hmm. Emperor Haile Selassie, happened to be one of the
only
key
one.
Founding fathers.
Ethiopia, the only place that was not colonized.
Not colonized, yes. Except very, very briefly during mm-hmm. the Second World War
yes.
by the Italians.
By the Italians.
When they were paying back it. For mm-hmm. their defeat mm-hmm. at mm-hmm. Adwa. Mm-hmm. What we need to do really in order to somehow get away from these superficial, for example, artificial boundaries which were imposed upon us
mm-hmm.
by Chancellor Bismarck of Germany, mm-hmm. 1884 in Germany.
Yeah, and the Berlin
with
Conference.
Not a single
African person present at the meeting. Absolutely. Look, I teach imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one of my courses. And we talk about these things because oftentimes when people don't know the history and the historical context of a place, they end up forming assumptions and opinions about a place they've never been.
Mm.
And my students who, many of them have, some of them have not traveled out the United States, some of them have never been to Africa. And so they may turn on the TV and they may look at, you know, there's those commercials that, you know, please donate a dollar, you know, to a malnourished child. And in their assumption, they assume that why can't they just why can't they find a job? Why is there poverty there? Why is it afflicted with certain disease? Why is there always political instability? But with that why, there's always a root cause to it. There's always historical context.
Mm.
So with the continent of Africa, not only do we have artificial borders, we have mental borders. We have psychological borders and we have physical borders. The physical borders, of course, happened with the Scramble of Africa in 1884 when no African leader was present and all the leaders came together, European leaders came together and said, you know what, let's carve this map here. And I would show my students the map of Africa previously before it was carved out mm-hmm. and how it looks now and
right.
all the boundaries
right.
that were put in place and,
right.
and how they pushed people in different groups and how they created boundaries where no boundaries existed before.
Right.
And so with that understanding, and I think it's not only just outside of Africa that people don't have this understanding, it's within the continent themselves that they actually lack the historical context. Not everybody, but there are some, and maybe the new generation that are coming up has to take a step back to understand that there's symptoms and then there's root causes. And as much as we try to get away from the historical context of colonialism and mm-hmm. imperialism, mm-hmm. it still has remnants today. So we can't just throw it away. We can't just forget it. We can't just say, well, okay, we're in a state of independence. Decolonization has already happened. But neo-imperialism has not ended.
Very interesting. Hashim, we do have many ministries of education.
Mm-hmm.
In Africa, any particular reason why some of these things are not part of the curriculum?
Yeah, that's why we in the International Peace Quest Institute have been advocating for a change of paradigm, mm-hmm. going to the root of the issue, and also an intellectual liberation.
Mm. You need a paradigm shift.
A mm-hmm. paradigm shift. And an intellectual liberation from the superficial narrative of history.
Mm-hmm.
And also we are advocating and trying to engage people of thinkers and intellectuals in other cultures.
What about someone, in fact, who would say what is needed is to decolonize the intellect that you are talking about?
Oh.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Liberation, the intellectual liberation is liberating your mind. And change, you know, starts with consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
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 Social, political.
Absolutely.
Consciousness.
Then, yeah.
Absolutely. Awareness.
Absolutely. Awareness and consciousness.
And but how do ordinary people access that? If their governments, for example, do not help them, for example, to provide some kind of civic education.
Oh, well, Shaka, that's okay. A great question. And that actually helps me get to what I want to really say today, which is, I think if we're speaking about Africa or Sudan mm-hmm. or America or mm-hmm. the whole world,
mm-hmm.
there should be a new approach to our understanding of the human story,
mm-hmm.
period. North Africans, Arabs, blacks, whites in America, Chinese, whatever. I always say that.
When you talk about the human story, what exactly do you mean? Because the last time I checked, if you want, at least a former president of the United States, Richard Nixon, once said in an interview that if you want history to be favorable to you, either you write it yourself or commission someone to write it on your behalf.
That's what has happened.
Well, that's what needs to change.
Yeah.
And that's what actually is happening now in Sudan. Mm-hmm. With the people who are paying with their lives peacefully. You see, this is the change that we are hoping will take root, not only in Sudan and Africa, but globally.
Absolutely.
The change that when people see the light and they know what they want and they can organize themselves peacefully, no power in the world can stand on their way. No power.
When they mobilize and organize.
And by the way, now I am very happy to say that what is going on in the Sudan and the battle that the Sudanese people are engaged in, they are in the front line of the birth of a new civilization and a new awareness. And a new popular movement that is peace-centered, that we have been always advocating for, you know, to change the paradigm and to make the paradigm shift.
And it may not happen overnight.
No,
and I think people have to understand that with revolutions, that
it's a process.
Democratization is a process.
It's not
something that happens overnight.
It's not an incident,
nor
an event.
Absolutely.
And by the way, here, the good news is that now, as you see, the African Union, Abiy's, proposition to solve the problem, the Troika.
You mean Abiy Ahmed,
the
Prime Minister of Ethiopia.
When he went to Sudan with his proposal for peace. And, you know, Ethiopia having the history, you know, like Prophet Muhammad, when he was in a very hard time, he sent his associates to Ethiopia because he said to them, there is a king here who will protect you. So, I mean, there are the symbolism and the history. And that's actually what I wanted to say earlier about the Nile Valley and Sudan and the beginning of humanity, because Africa is the cradle of humanity. We start there. And so it's time for us that we understand that we are one human family.
Unfortunately, like Sudan, there is no democracy in Studio 47, because when the producer says you have to go, you have to go.
I know.
You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of our discussion in a moment. So please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number is 202-619-3111 and the U.S. country code is 1. Call us direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to turn down the volume on your radio or television and keep your comments brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Gidiu Yuwat, and we appreciate all of the audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook. You can watch our show there and leave a comment. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
A on the next Straight Talk Africa. The newly elected Nigerian United Nations General Assembly President pledges to focus on peace and prosperity for the most vulnerable. Can this be achieved in such a diverse continent? Nigeria at the helm of the UNGA on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Aya, you are there? Yes, please. And today we are talking about political transitions in Africa. Our guests are Dr. Yetunde Adubesan Omede, Professor of Global Affairs and Politics at Farmingdale State College, and Dr. Hashim Eltine, Founder and President of the International Peace Quest Institute. And of course, Aya Chebi joins us from the Ethiopian capital in Addis Ababa. Good evening again, Aya. I see we probably lost her. Let me come to you again. Farmingdale rings a name because it must be somewhere in Long Island.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, because as an undergraduate student in New York, I had the privilege of doing an internship at Newsday.
Oh, Newsday, yes.
In Melville.
Melville, yes, it's Long Island.
Very interesting.
Yes.
How long have you been there?
I've been there probably about more than four and a half years now.
Very interesting. Now, let's go back to the land of the Oga Pata Pata.
Oga Pata Pata.
Nigeria, of course, happens to have the distinction of being the most populous nation on the African continent.
Yes.
And also happens to have the largest economy on the continent and has many, many incredible things, including, of course, Nollywood.
Absolutely.
Now, we talk about, when we talk about democracy, it looked like 4 years ago that Nigeria had actually gotten it right. And to be honest with you, from a bit of my research, it seems to me that there have only been two elections since independence in 1960, which have actually been regarded both by the Nigerians and the international community as having been free, fair, transparent, verifiable, and credible. We're talking about June 12, 1993, which was actually apparently won by the multi-billionaire Mashoud Abiola, and was annulled by General Ibrahim Badamasi Babangida. Do we know any particular reason why General Ibrahim Badamasi Babangida did what he did to the Nigerians and to African democracy?
You know, there's so many different theories as to why that did happen and why he made that decision. But at the same time, you know, one of the historical components about Nigeria when we had our first, I would say, democratic president was that there's a turn after gaining our independence and sort of ushering into a new wave of democracy. I believe that leaders started to see that, you know what, in order for us to be the giant of Africa, right, and in order for us to get it right, we have to ensure that our elections and our electoral process is right. Although we haven't perfected that area as much, but I still believe that we are on the trajectory of doing the right thing by the people of Nigeria.
But Yetunde, you have only actually done that twice, 1993 and 2015.
But like I said, democracy is a process. It's a process. And although people may say that, look, it should happen overnight, 10 years, 15 years, can we quantify the time and space of when a full democracy comes into blossom?
Yeah, but you take one step forward, and then
take one step.
We take 3 or 5 steps backwards.
And so the thing about this is that our government is not a machine. It's made up of individuals.
Correct.
Right? Individuals who all have different agendas. Individuals who all have a different vision of where they want to take their country. And unfortunately, in times in history, we get those individuals who their vision encompasses the nation as a whole. Their vision is not self-righteous, doesn't fill with ego, but it's about the betterment of the people. And at times you get leaders who may be opposite from that.
Right.
So we have a pendulum swing that happens in politics and in democracy. And unfortunately, because the government is not made of machines, but it's made up of individuals who has particular visions for a country that can either take the country forward or can take the country backward, which is why many of these new democracies find themselves in that pendulum swing of sometimes we're one step forward and then automatically a new leader comes in or one of his part of the political elite still holds on to that power and we're stuck in a pace, you know, place and time. And for many of them, they have been stuck in a place and time. Equatorial Guinea, stuck in a place and time. Uganda,
Equatorial Guinea, you're talking about the land of Teodoro. Obiang,
yes.
Basongo.
Because when you are unable to unleash power, you keep a country, unfortunately, hostage.
You talk about Equatorial Guinea, and in another breath, you bring in Uganda. Any particular reason?
No, just thinking back to, you know, Idi Amin and just looking at different revolutions and different coups and the different styles of leadership.
But I have news for you, because in fact, the incumbent Ugandan president,
yes, he's very, yes.
Yoweri Museveni, mm-hmm. The last time I checked, he has been in power about 32 years.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably
one of the longest on
the African continent.
Yes.
When you talk about Teodoro Obiang,
mm-hmm.
you talk about Paulo Biya of
mm-hmm.
Cameroon,
mm-hmm.
you go to Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? He also did a very interesting thing a couple of years ago when Teodoro Obiang was the chairman of the African Union.
Yes.
He awarded him the nation's highest award
mm-hmm.
for what he said was for Obiang's promotion of African democracy.
Yes. And so that's one of the things that we also need to talk about is that the relinquishing of power and the transfer of power. We want transitional democracy, but we are unwilling to transfer power. You have a youth population bulb in the continent of Africa, and there are three things that are keeping young people from arising to places in politics. It's money, godfatherism, and corruption. And those are the three main areas that keep well-educated, well-intentioned young people from actually transitioning and actually helping democracy blossom. So until we're able to kind of tackle those three things, we have many bills that allow young people to run, right? We have in Nigeria the not, you know, never too young to run and different bills that are trying to galvanize young people to run. But do you know how much it costs to run a politics, to run a campaign in African countries?
Billions of dollars.
So a well-intentioned, well-educated, well-exposed young individual who has all that it takes to rise up in the political ranks is held back by money, doesn't probably have the godfather behind closed doors, and corruption.
Unfortunately, Yetunde and Shim, time happens again not to be my best ally.
No.
Let's go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers from the African continent. Hey, Tedla from Ethiopia, how are you?
Yes, good afternoon, Shaka. How are you doing, Shaka?
I am hugely
very
terrific,
well,
and it's nice to hear your voice, except that I feel very sorry for you because of some of the developments, you know, in your homeland.
Yes, the internet disconnection you got from your callers in Addis Ababa is exactly because we have been shut out from the internet for the last 10 days, especially the so-called coup in the Baghdad in Ethiopia. And when the gentleman, the doctor, talks about Sudanese, believe it or not, when my first day out of my country, the first man who gave me a ride in Belgium was a Sudanese. And I asked him, how do you give me a ride? You look like me. That's the reason. So we Africans, I heard from the lady from Addis Ababa, we are one people, Shaka.
Mm-hmm.
We are one. The saddest thing what I hear in my country is that after that partition by the Germans in 1800, whatever, now the educated Africans, Ethiopians, are trying to partition Ethiopia in tribal line.
Mm-hmm.
This is the worst nightmare for all Africans. They should understand. Partitioning Ethiopia is not going to achieve anything for Africans. It is a disaster. It is just demonizing ourselves. What I am praying for Sudan is to hold on, no tribalism, fight the dictatorship, and believe you people, I am 100% believe that the Sudanese are going to win, even if there are many, many neighboring countries who are stacking their faith on them. I know that the Saudis are not sleeping. They are trying to use the military like they did in Egypt, but they have to keep, if Sudanese popular uprising is squashed, it is not good for us too, because we are in the same box whether we like it or not. There is no democracy in Ethiopia. People are believing we have a nice president. No. The last week, Saturday, so-called coup, it is just a power struggle in one part of Ethiopia, which is termed to be a government takedown, which is not true the case. Now, no information is flowing. Misinformation is a campaign, and then Ethiopia is one of the countries who are going to be giving help for Sudan. It's impossible. African Union should take over that negotiation, because Ethiopia is not a credible country. Right now, Ethiopia has her own problem. It is not going to solve anything for Sudan. That's what I want to tell to my friend. African Union should take responsibility and try to do the right thing for the people of Sudan. Ethiopia is in a big trouble, Shaka. I have been telling you that Ethiopia's situation is getting from worse to worse, because this is a war to divide our country into 9 or 10 pieces, tribal Batusta, which we do not accept. It will be, this is close to the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa. So this is a warning for all Africans who are hearing me. Ethiopia is in a big, big trouble. She needs African help, please.
Tedler.
Yes.
If by any chance Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed was watching Straight Talk Africa as you talk.
Yes.
Is there anything specifically that you would say to him?
Yes, politely. Yes, politely, yes. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, when he comes to America, I put on my Facebook, we have to rally behind this man because he is our savior, because he said black and white, we have to be united as an Ethiopian and solve our problem. One is now, he is doing the opposite. He is doing exactly the opposite. He is hijacked by the extremist nationalist Oromo group, and he is doing what they asked him
I
to
see.
Do. And the sad thing is that if he goes on like that, Ethiopia is going to be, he will be known as a man who dismembered Ethiopia. That's what
I thought that you'd have. I thought that we agreed on you are being polite.
I'm polite, sir. I didn't say anything. I didn't curse the Prime Minister. But he has two chances. Either to be remembered as a man who saved Ethiopia or as a man who partitioned Ethiopia for the worst.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Well,
I would like to jump on what you said. Mm-hmm. The three evils, you know, that are bedeviling Nigeria, but they are global.
Oh, global.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to mention here, you know, like this is the diagnosis of our problem everywhere, in Sudan, in Nigeria, in Africa, in the world.
But why don't we embrace democracy, which is really a reflection of social, economic, political justice for all of us?
Well, it seems to me that we
are talking about an equal opportunity employer here.
No, because some countries view democracy as westernized. They believe it's the
some
implementation.
Some countries or some individuals? Some individual rulers.
Yes, they believe that it's the implementation of Western values, which is what they're trying to push back
against.
But
aren't these individual rulers?
Yes, I mean,
who would like to justify their hold on to power?
It can be viewed that way.
By using undemocratic means.
The culprit is three evils: racism, militarism, and greed.
Yeah.
In terms of what is moving people.
What about tribalism?
Well, I mean, it's including.
What about sectarianism?
All.
What about selfishness?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, great. I mean, you know, that's
there's
it.
There's many
so,
causes.
So what we are advocating for a change, really, is that we should actually, you see, the Sudanese revolutionaries, what are they saying? They are saying their slogan, freedom, peace, freedom, peace, and justice. That's their slogan. What I'm asking them to do now, and this is for the future, is to organize a movement called the Sudan Freedom, Peace, and Justice Movement. This should be a beginning of a new movement that can run eventually for office and be a tent for all the new youth. And I here I'd like to salute, you know, the Kindakas of Sudan, the women of
Sudan.
And by the way, you know, Shaka, that this book was Liberation was dedicated to my sister, who is my soulmate, and who actually is a martyr of the revolution.
Really?
Because she died 6 months before the revolution, and she died. She's a journalist, and she was persecuted, and she had to leave the Sudan to go to Dubai. And she was persecuted because she was a very brave woman. And she's not only persecuted by governments.
Yeah.
She's persecuted by the society.
By her colleagues. By her
see? And by other women. And by people in our family.
May her soul rest in eternal peace.
Yeah, so this is very personal to me, you know. And so I salute all the Kindakas. Their contribution to the revolution was incredible. And honestly, I feel that the train that the Sudanese have started, I want all Africans, all Arabs, all Americans to join this train, because this is a train of renewal, societal renewal. And here I would like you to just let me say the vision of and the mission of our International Peace Quest Institute. And we have been on this journey since 85, when I incorporated this as a political refugee in Paris, France. This is what it is: promoting a 21st century societal transformation via the advocacy for a new culture of freedom, peace, unity, social and economic justice through intercultural, inter-ethnic, and interfaith research, education, and collaboration. This is our offering to the whole world.
Very interesting. But let me ask you this question. We experienced, of course, revolutions in North Africa, which were characterized as the Arab Spring, even though they were probably the African Spring. Can we, for example, find out why, for example, what happened in Tunisia seems to have succeeded? At least it seems to have been consolidated. And yet what happened in Egypt, Tahrir Square, you can see even the manner in which the man who was the first probably democratically elected president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, you even saw how he died.
Yeah.
You now have Abdel Field Marshal, I guess, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who also, by the way, in addition to being president of Egypt, happens to be the chairman of the African Union. Then you have Libya.
That's which is a whole other...
And then, you know, we have this issue.
What is it that... the Tunisians really did right? For example, they continue on the path of democracy, correct?
Yeah, because, again, it's a question of consciousness and awareness. And it's a call, you know, here during the Clinton era, remember they used to say, it's the economy stupid? I would like to say, it's the vision stupid.
It's the vision stupid.
It's all about the vision. You have to have the right vision. And the Bible says...
In fact, someone has said
and
that...
And who the power is transferred to.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's very critical.
Someone
at that
has said that part of the problem of Africa, really, is that there is in their words, not mine, a leadership deficit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, absolutely, absolutely, because our definition of leadership varies, and the representation of what leadership was, unfortunately, was not a good representation to a lot of African leaders.
I would like to inject here something very important, Shaka. Mm-hmm. It's the question of thought, mm-hmm. and thought leadership, mm-hmm. and thinkers, mm-hmm. and free thinkers. Mm-hmm. We have a state that when people are educated, they are employed by the state, and they are bought by the state. So we are deprived of a very important part of free thinking.
Is that, education, or are you talking about being skilled?
No, but the thing about it is that there's a difference between management and leadership. Mm. Many of the countries are governed by poor managers.
Exactly.
These are people who, they know how to, maybe the systems, the processes, but they don't know how to lead people. There's two different things. The worst thing that you can have is a manager, but there's the worst thing that you can have is a manager in a leadership position and doesn't know how to lead, or a leader in a management position but doesn't know how to manage. What you need is both of them, and we don't have both working at the same time.
Right.
So that person that we're looking to, who will come out and uplift the people, who will come on TV and say, I hear your concerns, I hear your desires, I am with you, I am standing side by side with you. There's no empathy when it comes to a lot of the African leaders. I don't know if it has to do with culture, you know, the absence of the thought leadership. And then this idea of how do we define politics?
They don't consult their people.
Because they have a different definition of what politics is. They have a different definition of what public servants are.
What about someone who says that those type of people that you call leaders, in fact, are probably patriotic to their stomachs, the stomachs of their families, not society?
But the thing about leadership is that just because you are in a leadership position does not make you a leader. And so we're pointing to presidents and we're saying you're a leader because you are in a leadership position, but they don't exhibit the characteristics of leadership. So we can't necessarily call them a leader.
But what about some of these leaders or rulers who, for example, stay in power for a long time, mm-hmm. and the justification from them why they stay in power for so long, including their supporters, mm-hmm. is that these are particularly uniquely gifted individuals.
So, in fact,
if they did not exist, those societies would probably collapse.
Okay, so in politics, we have three forms of legitimacy. We have the legal rational legitimacy, we have traditional rule, and we have what we call a personality or charismatic sort of leadership. And so they fall under the personality clique. So we had Gaddafi, we had all of these different leaders who believed that they had a supernaturalness to them. They believed that they were gifted, that they were anointed by God, and this is why they were in their position. It was that justification. And you will see that even with Idi Amin, that personality clique, people would rile against them. Even Gaddafi, the dressing, the talking, all of that sort of within their mind frame. But there's a problem with that when you feel that you are anointed and not appointed. Right?
Well, unfortunately, time happens not to be
on our side.
Ally.
Okay.
And on that note, our guests today were Yetunde Odubasan Omede, Hashim Eltine, and Aliya. In the show, we were joined by Aya Chebi. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.